Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It has been a great privilege of mine to have worked over the years with a man who has been very much in the crucible of that war for the free world for quite some time, often in senior capacities of our United States government, including most recently as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. He also served as America's representative to Finland and to Turkey. Today, he is a distinguished fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and also holds a position as the visiting scholar at the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He is Ambassador Eric Edelman and always a welcome guest here. Sir, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Frank.
Well, I don't really know where to begin. In the course of your distinguished career, you have covered so many of these topics, but perhaps we can begin with the very important contribution you and another of our friends and colleagues, former Ambassador Robert Joseph, wrote about recently concerning the Iran deal. This is, it seems, less and less of a deal all the time, to say nothing of a good deal. Talk about what we have here as a result of this diplomatic fandango.
Well, to call this a deal is really a misnomer. The president unveiled this last Thursday with great fanfare, as then did Secretary Kerry, and the Department of State put out a fact sheet which purported to represent the terms of the deal, if you will. But what we now have seen with the passage of a week's time is that there is a U.S. fact sheet, which, according to the press accounts I've seen, was never shown to the Iranians and therefore was never signed off by the Iranians. Almost immediately, the Iranian negotiator, Foreign Minister Zarif, tweeted that that this was spin. And yesterday we had an authoritative statement by the Supreme Leader saying that the Iranians had not agreed to any of this. The Iranians have put out their own fact sheet. I gather there's a French version of the fact sheet that at least some journalists have seen. And then there's a joint statement, that a very vague one, that was issued by the EU negotiator, Mrs. Mogherini, and Zarif, all of which basically purport to say different things about different elements of this deal. So notwithstanding the hype that the president put on it, there is really no deal yet. There's just an agreement to keep negotiating until the next deadline, when I'm sure the Iranians believe they'll be able to get even more concessions out of the U.S.
Ambassador Edelman, I have been reduced to calling this national security fraud, because it really seems to me that what the president is engaged in here is not simply a misnomer, but it's a misdirection. It's malfeasance, even, that he's claiming to have accomplished things that have not yet been accomplished, if ever they might be.
Well, it is of a piece where the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded before anything had been accomplished. Look, not only was the president's claim a giant overreach and really a misleading of the American people, but there's also another level of dishonesty here. I mean, the president said he hopes for a robust debate about this alleged deal with Iran, but before drawing another breath, he was immediately casting political aspersions on his opponents by suggesting the only grounds for opposition would be politics, not genuine concern for the nation's security, and that there are no real alternatives to the deal, although he said all along a bad deal is worse than no deal. What he appears to be saying is there's no deal other than my deal. And if you're against it, you're a warmonger in favor of war with Iran. So he's not really interested, I don't think, in a serious, robust debate, unfortunately.
What, in your professional assessment, Ambassador Eric Edelman, is the alternative to what the president has put forth? Is there, in fact, something other than war? And if there is, how do we get to it instead?
War is never a step that anybody wants to take, or acts of war, never a step that anybody wants to take lightly. And certainly it's, I think, an obligation of statesmen to try and find alternatives short of that. The problem here is we're dealing with a level of diplomatic malpractice that's so high it's almost hard to know where to begin. This thing has been very poorly negotiated from the beginning. You know, one wonders if any of the State Department negotiators has ever bought a rug in this part of the world, because you really there's a certain amount of negotiating style and understanding your opponent and trying to understand what they need and what they want and what your red lines are. What we've had really is a series of concessions from the starting point, which was to freeze and then shut down and dismantle Iran's infrastructure for enriching uranium and also for developing a plutonium pathway to a bomb. And every single one of the key elements of that negotiating posture have been given away over time, to the point that between now and July 1st, one shudders to think what the U.S. might give away, since they've already given away so much.
We have been encouraged to believe that this will, in fact, end all paths to an Iranian bomb. One of the things I'm struck by is the number of people who have made it their life's work to promote nuclear nonproliferation who are now mustering out to support this deal when, as you say, and I think most other sentient experts say, this is, in fact, to use Bibi Netanyahu's phrase, paving the path to the bomb, not getting rid of it, and creating conditions under which there will be both be an impetus for proliferation and a new set of ground rules that will enable it.
There are two facts here, I think, that are important to bear in mind. One has got to do with the sort of nonproliferation treaty regime, and the other is the situation in the region. And both are interacting in a way that is driving the other states in the region who are looking at this negotiation, and I'm talking predominantly about countries that have been our allies and continue to be our allies, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Jordan, Turkey are looking at this, and I think the prospect of either a nuclear armed or Iran as a nuclear threshold state, which is essentially what this deal does, it puts the imprimatur of the international community on the idea that Iran, within a very short period of time, could have a nuclear weapons capability. Most of those other states in the region, particularly given Iran's already active effort to establish its hegemony in the region, are not going to sit by and watch that happen. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has made it very clear that they're not going to let that happen. They have ways and means of their own, I believe, to develop a very rapidly an offsetting nuclear capability to Iran's. And I think then you will see the nuclear cascade that many of us have been worried about for some time, and a number of senior government panels dating back almost a decade have been warning about. And so it is an irony, I think, that people who have made Global Zero and nuclear nonproliferation their life's work are now celebrating something that, in my view, is driving a wooden stake through the heart of the nonproliferation treaty, which is actually one of the few accomplishments of arms control since the advent of the nuclear age.
Not perfect, but certainly, relatively speaking, an impressive record. We're almost out of time. Mr. Ambassador, let me just very quickly ask you, what do you make of how President Obama is managing the Israeli relationship, and what does that portend for this whole enterprise with Iran?
Well, since the very beginning of his term, relations with Israel have been parlous, to say the least, and it's gotten worse over time. I don't, in my lifetime, cannot remember senior government officials on background subjecting an allied prime minister to the kind of campaign of calumny that Bibi Netanyahu has been subjected to. I don't agree with everything that Prime Minister Netanyahu has said or all of the policies he's followed, but Israel is one of our closest allies in the region. It's, in the first instance, the country probably most affected by Iran's developing nuclear capability. And for the president to treat essentially an adversary like Iran with greater understanding and more sympathy than he does a longstanding ally like Israel is, I think, a travesty.
Well, it's a travesty, and I fear probably it is an invitation to disaster if people recognize this as evidence that it's now open season on Israel. God help not only the Israelis, but all of us, I think. Ambassador Edelman, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. I appreciate so much both your past service to the country as, among other things, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, and that you're providing today at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and at my alma mater, Johns Hopkins University. I hope you come back to us soon. There's so much more to talk about. Next up, we'll talk with Bill Gertz, one of America's finest national security reporters, about this fraudulent non-deal with Iran and much more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz for the Center for Security Policy. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned last weekend that the Iran-Lasan-Yemen axis is very dangerous to humanity and must be stopped. Netanyahu was referring to Iran's efforts to expand its influence in the Middle East, including in Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, and recently in Yemen, while Western states are engaged in nuclear talks with Iran in Lausanne, Switzerland, that appear on track to produce a deal which will not reduce the threat from Iran's nuclear weapons program and will legitimize this program. Iran is backing Houthi rebels that recently ousted the elected president of Yemen. Iranian Supreme Leader Khamenei said at a rally this month, "Death to America." Netanyahu is right. The Iran-Lasan-Yemen axis is a threat to humanity. It is time to stop the nuclear talks. No deal with Iran is better than a bad deal. Mr. President, no deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Bill Gertz, one of the most distinguished national security journalists of our time. He writes for the Washington Free Beacon, where he is a senior editor, and also for
The Washington Times, with his prize-winning Inside the Ring column. He is the author of 6 best-selling books and a great guest and very valued contributor to this program. We're always happy to have him with us. Bill, welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the show.
You've been writing, Bill, as one would expect, about the so-called deal. In our previous segment, Eric Edelman made clear that there's really no deal, and whatever there is seems to be as much a matter of disagreement as agreement. When you've looked at this and talked with your extraordinarily valuable sources inside the Pentagon and elsewhere, what do you make of what's been cooked up so far, specifically with respect to what's covered and what's not, and also the verification elements?
Sure. To me, the key deficiency, aside from the verification issues, which are massive, is the fact that the agreement does not focus on the main military component of Iran's nuclear program. It's a large military facility southwest of Tehran called Parchin. Parchin was not mentioned by name in the fact sheets that were put out by both sides, and yet it is at the core of what needs to be done to prevent Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon. This is the facility that the International Atomic Energy Agency has been trying to gain access to since 2012. That's when they discovered a large containment vessel there where it is suspected that explosive experiments were carried out. That is, high explosives against a uranium pit to measure the pressure. This is the key element in building a nuclear bomb. And yet again, it got short shrift in the fact sheets.
Short shrift in the fact sheets, and that's the best treatment that those fact sheets gave. Most of them gave very conflicting accounts of what has been agreed. And Bill Gertz is our guest, the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon and prize-winning columnist at the Washington Times. Bill, you were describing the Parchin story. We've had people, including the deputy national security advisor to the president, Ben Rhodes, make rather sweeping claims about the verification aspects of this agreement, as they describe it, with Iran. Specifically, Ben Rhodes said on CNN earlier in the week that this agreement will provide anywhere, anytime inspection options for the United States and the international community, including of military facilities and undeclared sites in Iran. Is there any basis in fact, as far as you're able to tell, for such statements?
Absolutely not. In fact, the experts that I talked to on verification said that it's not unprecedented verification, as the president has claimed. First of all, Iran has been one of the most inspected countries by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and yet it has still violated the Non-Proliferation Treaty by building these facilities, specifically at Fordo and Natanz. And yet they seem to have felt that in this framework, which will be hammered out in between now and next June into what the administration wants as a formal agreement, really doesn't contain good verification provisions. The language of the fact sheets, which is all we have to go on at this point, talks about things that Iran will do or that things that Iran has agreed to. There's very little of what Iran has agreed to, and clearly it has not agreed to challenge inspections, that is, inspections any place, any time. In fact, the Iranian leadership has come out and said as much just in the last few days.
No, and again, this is what makes me consider this whole enterprise really national security fraud, because we're being fed a line by the administration that does not seem to bear any resemblance to the reality of what would actually happen, at least according to the people who have to enable it on the ground, namely the Iranians. Bill, let me switch gears. You've also been doing, as always, extraordinarily important reporting on the nuclear threats to this country that continue to grow. Specifically, you described some testimony by the commander of Northern Command about what China is up to at the moment. Give us a flavor of that.
Yes. Admiral William Gortney is the U.S. Northern Command commander, and he met with reporters at the Pentagon and presented for the first time what I call the first time a senior military official has expressed concern about China's rapid development of nuclear forces. And in particular, he talked about what he said was three missile submarines that are now in the water and are on the verge of carrying out the first submarine patrols. He said this is a concern. It's the first time, that a senior official has said that. In the past, even the CNO of the Navy has tried to minimize the Chinese nuclear threat, all as part of this naive building trust program that the Pentagon is trying to do with the Chinese military.
Yeah, which has, as you've documented over the years, much to do with exposing them to our secrets by way of trying to develop a sense of confidence on their part about us, which is almost entirely unreciprocated, as best I can tell. And I appreciate so much your reporting on this. Bill Gertz, let me ask you about two other things quickly, Bill. One, you've described some Pentagon planning for somewhat exotic new weapon systems, including a lot of robotic capabilities. What's coming as you see it, and is it likely that we'll actually see that kind of technology innovation translated into weapon systems anytime soon, given the restrictions now on the budget?
A very difficult budget situation for sure. This was based on a speech by Bob Work, who's the Deputy Secretary of Defense. He gave a speech to the Army War College at a strategy session, and he talked about what he called the third offset. And they're talking about this term. This is an offset strategy which uses asymmetric means to counter enemies' larger advantages. In the case of the Soviet Union, it was tactical nuclear weapons. In the 70s, it morphed into precision-guided weapons. And he said the third offset is going to be robotics and automated systems. And it's a good idea, I think, but I think what they're really missing is that a lot of this is missing the information warfare part. The U.S. is trying to leverage its technology and its personnel, which are highly trained, while our enemies are moving in a different direction. They're using non-technical political warfare and legal warfare and things like that.
We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you, from your vantage point at the Free Beacon and the Washington Times, Bill Gertz. Finally, let me just turn to another statement that's been made by Ash Carter, the Secretary of Defense, recently in connection with this so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership. I'll be talking more about it shortly with Rick Manning, but I wondered what your sense was of his claim that this agreement, this trade pact, would be worth one carrier to the United States military.
Yeah, this is again the Obama administration's trying to remove the security element of our strategy in Asia, which is really built upon military power, and they're trying to shift it to economic power, and it's simply not going to work. I mean, basically, they're trying to challenge the Chinese, which is good, but doing Trans-Pacific partnerships is not nearly as sending the kind of message that we need to send, that we need to build up our forces. The Chinese naval buildup is extraordinary. I'm working on a story this week about that. In the past year, they've laid down the keels for 60 vessels, naval vessels, and they're planning to do an equal number in the coming year.
Well, we look forward to your reporting on that subject and coming back to us to discuss it with us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Bill Gertz, thank you so much for all the work you do. Keep it up, and we'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk with Mark Krikorian next. He'll give us an update on the coming surge of more illegal aliens. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're all part of your community.
We all play a role in keeping our community safe.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
Barack Obama will extend his losing streak in foreign affairs with this weekend's Summit of the Americas in Panama. He is compounding in our own hemisphere his disastrous record of appeasement elsewhere. First, he is removing Cuba from the list of state sponsors of terrorism as a further concession to the Castro brothers, whose regime has extensive and ongoing ties to the world's terrorists. Next, he will try to placate another terror-sponsoring state, Venezuela, by denying that it represents a threat to U.S. national security. Never mind that he formally attested to that reality just a few weeks ago in imposing sanctions on seven of its leaders. Under President Obama, America is neither feared nor respected by its adversaries, and that can only make the world a more dangerous place. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by the director and founding father of a marvelous organization in Washington, D.C. He is Mark Krikorian. The organization is the Center for Immigration Studies, truly an indispensable resource on matters involving border insecurity, executive amnesty, immigration dysfunctionality, and more. He is the author, most recently, of a very handy book, Open Immigration, Yay or Nay. Also, the author of How Obama is Transforming America Through Immigration. Mark, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us, sir.
Glad to be here.
We are getting unsettling reports that it's deja vu all over again, as with last summer's surge of unaccompanied children and a whole lot of other people. We are apparently going to have another of these tidal waves. Is that, in fact, in your estimation, in the offing, and what are its implications?
Yeah, it looks like it is. In fact, the numbers are already growing. They're not as high as last year, but they're higher than any previous year. And the estimates are maybe 40,000 of these supposedly unaccompanied, supposedly minors this year, and then an additional 35,000 family units. In other words, kids usually with single moms, but sometimes the whole family. And the point is that the Border Patrol is still being told to just give these guys a piece of paper and let them go. The reason I think that it's a little bit lower than last year is that we, through a combination, I think, of threats and bribes, have induced Mexico to do a more vigorous job at keeping the Central Americans out in the first place. And their deportations of Central Americans have doubled from Mexico back into Guatemala.
So that's one factor, but even that isn't stopping it. It's still very high. And the Border Patrol, I just talked to some agents a couple of weeks ago down in California, and, you know, they said, look, we are still basically unpaid consultants to the smuggling cartels because of the orders that are being given us from Washington to let people go.
Which is alarming on so many different fronts because, of course, as you point out, Mark, it's not just unaccompanied children or children with their moms. It's everybody from gangbangers to narco traffickers to perhaps terrorists who are coming across that basically porous border. And to the extent it's not porous, the guys who are supposed to be protecting it are unfortunately now being compromised by the kind of direction that they're being given by the administration. Talk also, if you would, about one other thing the administration's got going at the moment, which is this in-country refugee processing service for some of these, at least for these kids. What's that about?
Well, what they announced, and they announced this last summer, supposedly in response to the surge, is that they would set up, under the existing refugee program, an effort to screen young people in Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador before they leave and try to make it across Mexico, and then just bring them into the United States. Now, that's bad enough, but initially it was sold as something under the existing numerical caps and system of the refugee program. What they've added, though, since then, is that it's not just that, is that people who don't qualify as refugees, if they have relatives here, they can potentially be what's called paroled into the United States. In other words, just let in on the president's say-so. And the premise underlying this is the explicit assertion by this administration that the president has the authority to let in anyone he wants in any number into the United States, and that is, you don't like it, it's just too bad. This is a remarkable, breathtaking assertion of authority. And, you know, what happens when Yemen falls apart some more, or if there's a resistance to resettling tens of thousands of Syrian refugees? The president has said, basically, that he can just let in as many as he wants on his own say-so, whether Congress or the public like it or not.
Now, Mark, again, you are a deeply knowledgeable expert on this subject at the Center for Immigration Studies. What, in fact, is the law of the land with this regard? Is he doing it with authority that is somehow imputed or built into the law, or is this simply flatly inconsistent with the law of the land?
Well, it's taking a provision. There's something called parole in the law, and this isn't like criminal justice parole. What parole means in immigration, it does exist in there, is that if there's somebody, for instance, you know, he needs emergency surgery and is, you know, he can pay for medical care at the Mayo Institute or something like that, the administration has the authority to let this guy in, sort of shortcut the visa stuff for a specific emergency purpose. The Congress has continually tried to narrow that authority. President Obama is basically thumbing his nose at that effort and saying, no, because you let me let in people under very narrow circumstances, and the words in the statute, the wording is very, you know, has to be case by case, emergency situation, that kind of thing. He's saying, because it says that, I can let in anybody I want in any number I want for any reason I feel like. And he does not have authority to do that. Congress, though, needs to explicitly somehow prevent the president from doing that kind of thing. And it's going to be hard. This Congress is not going to be able to do it. That's the problem.
Well, it brings us to the related topic that I wanted to get into with you of the nomination of Loretta Lynch as the Attorney General of the United States, maybe considered as soon as next week by the United States Senate. It would appear, given the position that she has taken in support of what her predecessor, if she is confirmed, Eric Holder, has taken, to basically endorse this kind of presidential overreach, putting it mildly, unconstitutional, illegal act seems to me to be more accurate. What do you make of the prospect that the Senate may confirm someone who is really enabling this illegal behavior by the president? Does a vote for Loretta Lynch really amount to a vote for this amnesty by the United States Congress?
Absolutely. I mean, the Congress has a limited number of tools to use against the president. Impeachment's off the table. He's exempt from impeachment for all practical purposes. They already gave away their power of the purse by approving a budget bill. And, you know, with the Democrats in the minority, but still a large enough minority to maintain a filibuster, it's difficult for Congress to rein in a president who is willfully breaking the law. This is one area where they can, and it's been clearly established. There's now a record in the hearings to tie together Loretta Lynch's nomination. She's going to be the chief law enforcement officer of the country with Obama's record of lawlessness, not even just in immigration, but other areas. Immigration's, you know, where I actually know the most about it. So it seems to me pretty clearly this is the one area the Senate, the Republican Senate, has to send the message, we reject the president's Caesarism. We reject his lawlessness. If they vote for Loretta Lynch, they are telling Obama, go ahead, knock yourself out, violate the Constitution all you want. There's nothing we're going to do about it.
Yeah, which, again, plays us back into what he might well wind up doing in terms of really opening borders of this country even further. In that regard, let me just close, Mark Krikorian, with a quick question to you. There is some talk about him raising the refugee caps, perhaps to accommodate this influx of Syrians. David Miliband, a former foreign minister of Britain, now with one of the groups that is making money by bringing these refugees here, has said that we are obliged to take 65,000 Syrians, even though the FBI says they cannot vet these guys. Do you anticipate that we're going to see this kind of influx, and are you concerned about the security implications of it?
Well, I'm definitely concerned about security implications if it happens. Clearly, the president and the administration understands that politically this is a real hot potato for them. And so that's why they haven't just waved in all the, you know, ISIS refugees already. But yeah, the president has basically two ways he could let in huge numbers of Yemeni, even, let alone Syrian refugees. And that is through the regular refugee program, but that has numerical caps that have to be announced, delivered to Congress, that sort of thing. The other thing is literally, like I'd said, just paroling in people, letting them in outside any regulatory or legal framework. And, you know, both of those things are entirely possible. And to prevent that, we need to raise the alarm now to make sure that the president can't get away with something like this, announcing it on a Friday afternoon, you know, when no one will notice.
Yeah, perhaps at the America's Summit. We'll see. Mark Krikorian, your expertise and your analyses at the Center for Immigration Studies really are indispensable in this fight. I hope that they will be heeded by members of the Senate next week and the rest of us all of the time. Next up, Americans for Limited Government President Rick Manning joins us to talk about the dangers of the Senate giving President Obama a blank check on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today,
all right, let's go,
or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Richard Manning, the president of Americans for Limited Government, a wonderful organization in Washington, D.C., doing its level best to both keep government manageable and consistent with our Constitution and prevent malfeasance on the part of government officials, whether in the executive branch or, for that matter, the legislative branch. He formerly served as the chief of public affairs at the U.S. Department of Labor during the George W. Bush administration. Also had been for many years associated with the National Rifle Association. Rick Manning, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us, sir.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
You have been leading the fight at the moment on something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Maybe you could help us understand exactly what this negotiation is about and what you think is likely to come of it.
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a negotiation that's been going on for about 6 years between the United States and 11 other countries. It includes Canada, Mexico, Japan, Peru, Vietnam, Malaysia, and other countries in the Pacific Rim.
Not China, though. Is that right?
Not China. Although China would be able to join later, and I can tell you about that a little bit. But here's what they're trying to do. And this is why this is unique. Because this is a regional-wide treaty, trade deal, although it's not really a trade deal, a treaty, what they're attempting to do is they're attempting to rewrite the economic rules of the world. The countries involved in this treaty negotiation constitute 40% of the imports and exports in the United States. So we're talking about a huge amount of our economic wealth is involved in trading with these countries. We already have trade relations with all of these countries, so we're not opening up new frontiers. We're merely, what President Obama is doing, and he said this, is he's rewriting the economic rules of the game for those countries and for America at a time when we've seen what he's done domestically in terms of writing regulatory rules for the game here. And many of us are extremely concerned that he's not only overstepped his bounds, but the rules he's writing are counter to the United States' interests. So at the environmental side of things, the president's environmental advisors are going out to environmental groups and saying that we're going to do something about global warming and CO2 emissions through this trade regime. That doesn't sound like trade, and the reason it doesn't sound like trade is because what we discovered is while the deal isn't completed and it hasn't been made public, out of 27 sections in this agreement, only 5 actually deal with trade. The other 22 are regulatory agreements. And so when they go out and say, we're going to deal with CO2 emissions and global warming amongst all these countries, what is reasonable to assume is that we are effectively locking in President Obama's greenhouse gas regulations here in America in a way that a future president, a future Congress will not be able to change them if this gets enacted into law as a treaty, because that locks us into an agreement with 11 other countries that the Congress can't change. So that's one of the things where when you look at this deal, the TPP as a whole, you have to look it into the context of what a treaty does. And what it does is it subverts, it overrides existing law. And once Congress says that's what we want, at that juncture, future Congresses can't withdraw from it without going through an extraordinarily strenuous process that's almost impossible to achieve. So what President Obama is doing is he's locking in his agenda, his fundamental change, through a worldwide approach and hoping that the U.S. will go for it based on the false front of it being a free trade deal.
This brings us to the role that the Congress is playing in all of this, or might play in all of this. Of course, under our Constitution, which you prize as much as I do, Rick Manning, is the notion that the Congress, specifically the United States Senate, will play a very important check and balance role in treaties like this, I think, should be. And yet what we're being told is that the Republican-led Senate, and for that matter the Republican-led House, are poised to give the president something called fast-track authority that would be quite detrimental to that kind of oversight function and more importantly, the check and balance. Talk a bit about what's afoot with the so-called FTA.
Well, you know, that's a great question, Frank. There is a constitutional, in Article 2 of the Constitution, it lays out the treaty-making authority of the president very clearly. And that is a collaborative process with the U.S. Congress, particularly the U.S. Senate. And because treaties have a very specific overriding effect on the laws of the United States, the Founding Fathers very wisely made it so you had to have a two-thirds majority in the Senate in order to ratify a treaty. What fast-track trade authority would do is it would make it so that threshold of two-thirds was lowered to simple majority. Now, both houses would have to pass it by simple majority. And secondly, they would have to bring it up within a very short period of time. And the rumor coming out of the negotiations on the Hill is that it's going to be a 90-day time period where the treaty would have to be brought up. And lastly, Congress can't amend the treaty. So if there's some things in it that are just egregious, but they want some other aspects of it, they'll have to make a decision, not based on being able to say, we need to fix something. They won't be able to fix the treaty. So it has three basic components. Once again, simple majority, no amendments. It has to be brought up in a short time frame. What Senator Hatch is going to do in terms of a bill that he's introducing on Monday, and Representative Paul Ryan will do in a bill he's introducing on Tuesday, they're going to put a bunch of other things on it where they say Congress really wants the treaty to have, you know, this currency, no currency manipulation, or a whole variety of different things, the Christmas tree kind of approach. But the reality, Frank, is very simple. The TPP is already negotiated. So whatever Congress says they'd like to have in it, if it's not already in it, it isn't going to be there. So Congress will do that to make themselves feel good, like they're having a place in a role in this negotiation. But the reality is no member of Congress should vote for fast-track trade authority unless they believe that they're going to vote for the final version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that President Obama is going to submit, because they can't amend it. And they're going to have to do it in a hurry, and they're going to have a simple majority vote, which makes it easier for President Obama to pass it. So this is really, do you trust President Obama to submit a good trade deal? Anybody who's been paying attention last year can't say that they trust him to do an international negotiation that ends up in the United States' favor.
I'm thinking, Rick, of the Bergdahl swap, let alone the deals that he struck with the Russians putative deal that he's got with the Iranians. This is a man that you wouldn't trust, you know, with your bank account, let alone, I think, with major national interests. And as you say, my mind is kind of reeling that people like, well, Mitch McConnell, who the last time I checked wasn't all that keen about the president's EPA regulations as they might affect the coal industry. And here he's poised, as I understand it, to allow this fast-track authority that would lock it in and essentially deny him and his colleagues an opportunity to make any changes to it. Rick, this is such an important story. I appreciate you spending some time with us today on it, and I hope as this Hatch bill moves through the Senate, if it does, that we'll be able to take stock with you regularly and try to stay ahead of how this is shaping up as a real threat, I believe, to our national security as well as the larger national interests. Rick, thanks for all you do at Americans for Limited Government. Keep it up and come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.